Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bodhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So tonight, let to offer some reflections, some dhammic reflections, or maybe just call it general reflections about important issues, topics of our lives. And very often, of course, especially when we have a mixed group of people like now here, then of course it seems suitable to talk about something which we can all relate to, hopefully. If the language is too specific and too specialized and too much for experts and so forth, then of course the danger is very high that people get left out. So today one of the topics, the topic I've thought I'll reflect upon, is a topic of truth. And this morning actually we were also discussing a topic with Magda, another topic which I think everyone can relate to and is interested, is the topic of happiness. Or you could pick up some other topics, the general topics which I think everybody is interested in, say the topic of love, or the topic of equanimity, the topic of peace, peace of heart, peace of mind, the topic of contentment, you know, these kind of general human topics. And anybody, you know, even people who are not interested in spirituality or Buddhism or so, would find that interesting. They would find, yes, there's something really maybe to explore, or I'd like to hear something about it. And then, of course, as we, each of these topics have a lot of layers and side issues and so forth, how one can approach the issue. And the same, of course, applies to truth. When I suggest to reflect on truth, what actually does it mean? Of course, in Buddhism we have the central teaching, and Buddhism is about the Four Noble Truths. It's about, you know, definitely a truth matter, where, you know, in a nutshell, it speaks about the truth. And these truths are actually called noble. Noble truth of the reality of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, of suffering, stress, a sense of stress in life, and then the noble truth of the end of the origin first. Of course, first the noble truth of the origin of that stress and unsatisfactoriness, and then the noble truth of the ending of those causes, and then, of course, and the causes end, and also the real experience of dukkha ends. And then the noble truth of the path to be developed to realize the truth that which the Buddha speaks about, the complete ending of all suffering, the liberation of the heart, the realization of ultimate truth, we could say. But then, of course, ultimate truth is one issue, huh? And then there's also a truth which, of course, applies to our very everyday life, to the issues which we would call truth, truthful or not truthful, true or untrue, apply to our all personal lives. And, you know, when I would ask you to speak about your truth, speak your truth, what would you speak about? What would it be? What would you present? You know, I give you, say, 10 minutes. Now speak about your truth. And of course that could be, you could speak about what you experience right now. You know, you speak about your feelings, your mental processes, you're speaking about how you are within your body. You speak about what memories you have coming up and so forth. This is a kind of truth, isn't it? You were speaking about that what is real for you in that moment. And that is certainly, nobody can say to you, well, that's not true. I don't believe that. If you say, I believe, you know, I feel at this moment, I feel a little bit tensed and anxious in my heart, and I have all these concerns, and you know, which I've brought here from, say, maybe my family life or my job life, then nobody can say that's not true, because you know, it's undisputable, an undisputable personal truth if we present that what we experience in ourselves. But then maybe there are issues where we find it actually difficult to speak our truth or to get in touch with our truth, because we might be afraid what we would discover if you really look under the surface and looking at maybe some truth which in our psyche, in our personality, which would bring up very unpleasant feelings and emotions. And of course we all know that, for example, children, they are, at least up to a certain age, they always speak the truth. In the sense of what comes spontaneous to their mind, they just blurt it out, you know. And sometimes it can be shocking, and very often it's very amusing. And we love children for their ability to just, you know, say whatever is on their mind. And I think we've all been like that. We don't do that anymore, thankfully. It wouldn't be such a wonderful life, say, in an adult community, if everybody would just blurt out what goes through their minds. We'd probably create quite a few unpleasant moments for each other. But still, you know, maybe you remember, you know, that at certain times when you were small, when you were a child, then the parents would say, well, don't say that. One shouldn't say this. One shouldn't speak about this. You shouldn't even think this. This is naughty. Don't do that. You know, and then, of course, with children, and naturally have a tendency, and they want to be acknowledged for who they are, independent of, you know, certain kind of tasks or qualities they show. Just, you know, that, and you could even see children have a right to be acknowledged for who they are, independent of, you know, how what they say or how well they perform at school and so forth. But just, you know, simply for being who they are. Which doesn't mean, of course, that later on, if they do things which are off the mark, or they're unethical, or they're gross, they, you know, gross speech and so forth, that you don't correct them, say, oh no, you can't say that. This is not beautiful to speak like this. Please correct your speech, you know, speak a bit more pleasant and agreeable to the ear, not only to the ear, but also to the heart. Well, that's not what I mean. It's not so much about the ethical implications, of course, which all come into play, but it's more about that general acknowledgement for who we are. We all have a need to be evaluated, to in our lives have a sense of value given to us. It's difficult to give it to ourselves when we are small. We need help with that. And if we have reasonably skillful parents, then they will communicate that to us. They will give us a sense, you are just fine as you are. You don't have to do anything special to deserve my approval or my love even. And ideally, of course, in an ideal world, each parent, all parents would love their children unconditionally. But that doesn't happen, of course, because it's not an ideal world. And so parents tend to put conditions on things. And as children always want to, you know, to a great extent, they want to please their parents, they want to be acknowledged and accepted and loved, then sometimes things get suppressed, get put underground. They don't say this anymore, they don't think this anymore, they don't do this anymore, because they're afraid of the disapproval of their primary caregivers, of their parents or other important people in their lives. And then when this gets part of our psychological makeup, becomes a habit or a, a pattern in our personality and we carry this into our adult life, then of course this can carry on, the same old thing. We can either become someone who always tries to please everybody, you know, to say just the right things so that they feel acknowledged and appreciated by everyone around them. That could be a strong pattern in one's mind. Or maybe one lives with a kind of subtle nagging feeling in one's heart that, you know, concerning how one experiences oneself, that I'm not okay the way I am, you know. There's something fundamentally wrong with me. And by that I don't mean, you know, the fact that I'm not completely enlightened or awakened yet. But that I mean more on a fundamental level, just on a normal social level, or the way we look at ourselves. When we look into the mirror, I mean this figuratively, looking into the mirror, when we're looking at ourselves, we can't really find full acknowledgement of who we are without immediately finding into some kind of commentary, criticizing, judging, evaluating certain qualities, maybe a certain lack of qualities, or just overall dismissing ourselves. And this is the interesting thing, isn't it, especially in Western society, that there's a great problem, has been for a long time and probably will be for some time, of people not being able to really love themselves. I'm not saying like themselves, but really love themselves more in a kind of comprehensive sense, more in the sense of full acceptance for the way they are. And again, that doesn't mean that you're saying that you like certain character traits you might have, which are definitely worthy to be improved upon, but fundamentally that you can accept yourself, love yourself as you are. For some ears it might even sound strange, huh, to love oneself. Is that actually possible? And when we're looking into this issue, then it might be something you need to investigate for ourselves, you know, in the quiet moment in our lives. Well, how do I relate to myself? What is the inner dialogue like we experience every day, day in, day out, rather than dismissing it as, oh, it's all anicca, dukkha, anatta. Don't worry about it, using a kind of spiritual excuse not to face the issue, but really looking at it, really being careful and being daring and courageous to going into the detail. Maybe even writing it down. Sometimes actually the tendencies we have to dismiss ourselves as a human being and not giving ourselves value as a human being has so many quick notions in the mind, it very often escapes our attention. That's why then it's sometimes helpful to slow down and going into more kind of contemplative space. It could be, say, after a meditation here in the monastery, you know, when one goes back to one's room or so, when there's something there which isn't quite right, isn't quite how it should be, or is something I'm at odds with, something I'm arguing with, something I'm having an inner debate with, and so forth. And so you could call that's an exploration of truth, isn't it? We're trying to find, you know, the different layers of truth concerning our personality, our personal experience. This is also a way of taking responsibility for these more subtle strands of mental states, emotional states, feeling states, which goes on in our minds. And if they're not acknowledged, they influence our behavior, they influence our speech, and they influence the way we continue to live in the world, to live in the world from a very narrow perspective, from the prison of what we commonly call our self, the self, the sense of ego self, the limited self, which is to 95% or even more unconscious. You're not really You're not really conscious what is going on. And that is we could call that the ego self, which is basically dominated by ignorance. We don't know who we are. Not only do we not know who we are, but we don't know our motives for our actions. We don't know the certain thought patterns and emotional associations we have with the thought patterns, and how the emotions create new thought patterns, and the new thought patterns create another chain of emotional associations, and so forth, in circles. It goes round and round and round. But this going round and round and round is within a prison. It's within a cell, a very tight cell of the ego self. And if it really solidifies, we allow it to solidify, we never have a close look, then we will live within that cell to the end of our life. It will not stop by itself. It needs to be brought into the daylight. And sometimes we need help. And one of the help we can get is through spiritual practice, contemplative practice, through what we call in Buddhism exploration, to go to the source of things. The term we have in Buddhism is yoniso manasikara, to give attention and going to the source of things, to the root of the problem. And in order to go to the root of the problem, we have to be very truthful and very honest. In German, the words Wahrhaftigkeit, Ehrlichkeit, and so forth, they're beautiful expressions of what is needed. And to actually come to terms with our inner world in an open way. And we really show up. We don't have to show up for someone else. We don't have to tell everybody, what goes on in our minds. That's not really what's asked for. But also, some people would feel overwhelmed by that. But certainly we have to show up for ourselves, in front of ourselves, so we can look into the mirror and not make a grimace to ourselves. Because we don't like what we see. And by that I don't mean the pimples in our face, but I mean we don't like what we see in our mind, in our psyche, the way we are, the thoughts we have, the feelings we have, the tendencies we have in our lives. But to have a close look, to show up for ourselves, is a very good start. It's an important part, it's even a necessary part, to then move from this kind of conventional, this is certainly conventional truth, discovering conventional truth about ourselves. If we want to move to what we call ultimate truth, higher truths, the truths the Buddha is pointed towards, to be liberated from a sense of self completely, then we have to start there. We can't start at the other end with ultimate truth. And sometimes you find people in Buddhist circles or generally in spiritual circles who start at the other end, and then they dismiss their personal experience. And there's certain Buddhist platitudes, it's all anicca, dukkha, anatta, it's all impermanent, and just let it all go. The letting go mantra runs in their minds. But one gets the sense or the feeling they don't really bother to have a look. It's just a kind of mantra they have internalized with which they try to meet the inner world. But what they're actually doing, they're dismissing it. It was some time ago a famous term created by somebody who called it the spiritual bypassing. A bypass... is, say, on the roads, when you have a bypass, it's an Umgehungsstraße, something which, avoids the knotty parts of town. They build a bypass so that the traffic can flow. And so then, of course, you suggest to yourself, if I use this meditation technique or this spiritual mantra, I don't have to look at the knotty part in myself, the difficult parts, the not-so-charming, not-so-flattering parts. And so I take this spiritual bypass to go past it. But that doesn't pay out in the long run. We cannot do that forever. There seems to be a kind of a law in the theme of things, especially in the theme of a spiritual endeavor, of a spiritual discovery, that you can only fool yourself so long. And in life, maybe it will teach you a lesson. that might not be so pleasant then. And of course, okay, then you're that, then that, hopefully then you get that invitation when life is coming to you and giving you stronger lessons, you know, and stops you in your tracks, so to speak, blasts away the pillars under your bypass, so you actually have to look at your knotty parts, your constricted and contracted parts, the parts where you're not true, where you're not really truthful, you're not really honest, honestly seeing and looking into your own inner world. And so that is why actually the truthfulness has been called in Buddhism a paramita, a spiritual virtue, satcha paramita. In the paramitas, we have 10 of them. Well, one of them is called satcha. Satcha paramita is truthfulness. And that is, that it applies directly, that is an invitation for us to apply this truthfulness when we are, you know, with ourselves, first of all, so we can really, without pretense, acknowledge what we actually see, what we have with us. Yes, we can still have the reflective thought from the Buddhist teachings. This is only conditioning, conditioned things, conditioned phenomena. It's not who I am, you know, the things I see. It's not really who I am. But it seems to be, to acknowledge or to realize who we are, we have to acknowledge that first, those conditioned parts. Only then can we come to a point where we can see that who we truly are, which is not, of course, the conditioned. It's the unconditioned. The Buddha speaks about the unconditioned. That's who we truly are. That which is not born, which doesn't get created, which has no origin, or the deathless. You know, all these euphemisms the Buddha used to point into something beyond the conditioned part of ourselves. But to get there, we have to use the conditioned. Or you could also say, we have to face up for samsara to reach nibbana. If we can't really face up to samsara, acknowledge what samsara actually means for us personally, how will we be able to realize nibbana, the end of suffering, the goal of Buddhist practice? And so there we are. We're looking at ourselves. And then, of course, also an important aspect, I wouldn't want to leave that out, is truthfulness in our relationships with other people. Because most of you have made the experience probably that a lot of our passions, our irrational emotional reactions and so forth, get triggered by people whom we know very well. People who are close to us, our parents, for example, the children, of course, anyway, the children they perceive us more intuitively, the partners, marriage partners, other partners and so forth, community partners. And I think it's most people's experience that there our reactivity, our emotional reactivity is triggered most strongly. And sometimes we can't help, we just kind of, you know, so our buttons get pressed and we just react blindly without even thinking twice, without stopping a moment. We just blurt out something which is not really very pleasant and doesn't really create a social environment or a connection with the other person. And speaking about empathetic connection, but just a general human connection. But it creates division, divisiveness, because we're coming from reactivity, blind reactivity. It was actually, I remember a story by a spiritual teacher who spoke about that a man came to him after he'd spoken about this topic, about, I think he also spoke about truthfulness, and then a man, he was between his 50s and 60 or so, a bit old already, has been married 20 years. He took this to heart and he went home that evening and suggested to his wife that they tell each other the truth. So they sat down. Maybe one of those typical kitchen table talks, you know. They sat opposite each other. But rather than what they did before, is just telling each other the truth in a more accusative way or trying to persuade the other person of something, you know, to accept their standpoint or their point of view. They're doing it in a different way. They were just speaking their truth. In fact, actually, the man acknowledged they had been very close to divorce. They'd been married 20 years and they had been close to divorce for some time, but somehow they never ever got around to really resolve the issue in the air. So then they sat together and, you know, they talked till 3 o'clock in the morning, and they had spoken their truth to each other in a more, you know, skillful way, without accusation, without blaming, without dumping, you know, which of course is very inviting in, as you know, in relationships, that one makes the other person responsible for one's feelings or one's experiences, or maybe even for one's suffering. It's your fault because of you that I experienced this. But that's not speaking truth, is it? That's blaming. That's putting it outside, putting it out there, and not really having a look. Just like before, when we're not daring enough, not courageous enough to look at ourselves, and also we tend to have more the tendency to blame external circumstances for what we experience rather than taking responsibility. And so this, you know, this example of this man and his wife, that certainly wasn't pleasant, he was also sharing, it wasn't pleasant, and they obviously needed some time to digest that. But it was a beginning. And I don't know what went on, why they didn't bring up the subject much earlier, but very often, of course, people are afraid of the consequences if they speak their truth. How will the other person react? Even if they're not blaming and not trying to persuade the other person of their point of view, they might still feel, oh, maybe if I really say what I really feel, the person will say, well, that's it, I'm off, you know, don't want anything more to do with you. Or some other fear, you know, not being understood, or, you know, we have all sorts of, it can be very deep fears we have, you know, in relationship to the people who are our closest kin, or who are people who we have a very close relationship with. But to also in that area, for that to develop and to progress out of the tight prison cell of projections and dishonesty, and, you know, covering it over with silence and dismissal and disregard and so forth. I mean, if I speak like that, who wants to live in a relational world like that? Nobody wants that. Huh? But still, things happen, huh? And sometimes one finds oneself in a situation where, you know, long ago one should have really brought something onto the table. And of course it's very important to invite the other person kindly and in a friendly way. We as monks, we even have certain little regulations about that. You know, how to invite someone, if we want to give someone, we call it to give someone feedback. There's a certain points you have to consider. And one point is, for example, you have to consider the facts, that you speak about the facts, that you speak also about for the benefit of the other person, so also from a heart of metta. And that you're not trying to find fault with the other person, and you're not trying to blame the other person. And you're asking also the permission, of course. And this is, I think, what this husband said with his wife. He asked his wife, can we do this? Are you on board with this? He didn't say, you know, I come home and say, no, I want to tell you my truth now, so listen. That wouldn't go down very well, would it? You have to ask, you know, I really have a sense it would be good if we talk about how it really is, you know, simply how it is. How do we feel sitting here face to face with each other? What does it bring up? What is there in the underground? Let it put on the table and see what the outcome of that is. And yes, there will be a few painful moments. There will be a few kind of moments when one feels maybe embarrassed about, you know, one's own stuff, which is to acknowledge, you know, who wouldn't feel shy, and just imagine, you know, we would have to put out, say, all of, you have to kind of make public all the silly thoughts you had today. It'd be very embarrassing, wouldn't it? I wouldn't want you to know all my silly thoughts I had today. But there's no need. I don't need to share this with you. I don't really also dwell on this, you know. You might be even surprised to hear this, eh? that the monk sits there and admits that he has silly thoughts. But I don't only have wise thoughts all day. It's not just, you know, one wise thought after the other going on in when I, you know, in 24 hours. Definitely not. I remember one time my teacher Ajahn Sumedho, he had just given a 10-day retreat in Amaravati, and I came into his kuti, his hut afterwards, and he was in a kind of very silly mood. He was just cracking jokes and being a bit kind of Alban in German. And then when we looked at him a little bit, kind of, what's going on with you? He said, well, you know, people expect me to say all these wise things 10 days uninterruptedly, and now this is over. I allow myself to be a little silly for a few moments. So he gave himself the permissions to crack a few jokes and be a little bit silly. And this kind of bit of a little release, huh? Also of the kind of maybe the kind of view you can easily have of yourself when you at the receiving end of projections of other people. You're sitting there in the Dharma seat and you're giving all these wise reflections, you know. And then, you know, people look at you in awe, and oh, wonderful, all the wisdom you're pouring out on us. And of course you can't, it's difficult to not be affected by it. And then not to feel, you know, well, if they all looking at me in awe, if they find me awesome, then there must be some truth to that. But as a skillful teacher, you know, if one is in that role of teaching, then it's also very important that one can let that go when one is not in that role any longer. Yeah? When the teaching situation is over, you don't have to carry you around. You don't have to carry yourself around as a teacher any longer. That's just functional, and yeah, that's a reality in a certain situation, and then it has to be finished. It has to be put down. Otherwise, you're walking around, you know, wherever you go, and you expect people to acknowledge you as a teacher, as a wise person, as a wise teacher. But of course, the world will not do that. There will be people who will still call you foul names and make disrespectful gestures towards you, and then you will suffer. If you function like that, if you take this personally, if you take anything personally, you're up for a disaster. So we can see that when certain situations we can play roles, and we can play the teacher role, we can play the parent role, we can play the partner role, the employee role, the boss role, or whatever we are in, but we don't have to take that personally. In fact, if we don't take it personally, our life will be much easier and there will be much less suffering. If we can just acknowledge this is just a convention, I'm functioning right now. It's not to be taken personally, it's not to be taken around into all situations of my life. It's not to be used to make an identity of and build it up, you know, as somebody who is important, if it's, you know, on the kind of important side of the scale, or if we'd have a tendency to be very self-judgmental and even dismiss ourselves, it can go into the other direction, that we end up to developing a self which is based on a sense of dismissal and devaluation and not really seeing clearly that is again a creation. We've created this image of ourselves as somebody who has a lack of certain qualities, or someone who's, you know, full of all these wonderful qualities and has to show it to the whole world to be admired and appreciated. But all that is, of course, unnecessary, is not really what we should direct ourselves towards if we're interested in truth. If we know, if we're interested to find out who we really are, then we can see that this is the conditioned aspects. The conditioned aspect of ourselves is based on habits, habit patterns, mental, emotional habit patterns, which we've created over a lifetime. And they've gone to most, to a great extent, unconscious. And if we're not careful, if we're not mindful and aware, then they just play out in our daily behavior, in the way we speak and act in the world. And so, as spiritual practitioners and people who have maybe developed a rudimentary sense of awareness and mindfulness in our lives, we can see, you know, we can identify these patterns. We might even, you know, be very, very good to find that we're very good at it. We can find that our mindfulness is very deep, or, you know, our collectedness is very deep in the way we look at ourselves. And then be very careful that that doesn't go to our head. Because even that, even within the spiritual sphere, we can still be dismissive, we can still create a sense of self then, which is a kind of spiritually embroidered self. We would think we are already far more advanced than we actually are. It's just, again, a new image we've created of ourselves. But who we are, who we really are, is not an image. We are not mental images we create for ourselves. This is not who we are. This is, again, a conditioned aspect of ourselves. We've created an image which we can look at, which we can hold up, or we can carry around with ourselves. But there's no reality to it. It's just based on thoughts and maybe confirming emotions and so forth. But it can change very, very quickly. And it will change. Over time, it will change. And all the things which are changing in our lives, in our inner life in particular, are not really trustworthy. That which is changeful or changing is not trustworthy. It's not who we are. We cannot build a house upon it. We cannot take it as our refuge. The refuge the Buddha recommended is to take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Of course, that is the conventional way of speaking. And the Buddha stands, we're speaking about refuge, the Buddha stands for that inner knowing, the ability to know, to acknowledge our truth. First of all, the conventional truth. This is how it is at this moment. And if I don't identify with it, I'm not attached to it, then very, very quickly we get at least a glimpse of the other truth, the truth which is not limited by the conventions, conventional reality. And the Buddha knew that, the Buddha himself, he knew that. It was his realization that there's nothing worth to attach to, there's nothing worth to invest emotional energy in which is belonging to the fleeting world of phenomena, of activities of the mind, of objects of the mind. And Buddhas know that. And as we all have the potential to awaken, we can awaken our inner Buddha, you could say, and hopefully using our inner Buddha in our practice, we can take that as a refuge. And then the Buddha is not a refuge in an external sense, that we kind of repeating the word Buddha, Buddha, Buddha as a mantra, but we're actually connecting with it directly. As soon as we're aware, we've switched on this Buddha quality of just being aware for the truth of this moment. That might not sound like very much to you, but it's a start, it's a good beginning. We just have to increase those moments and make them, you know, more continuous, nourish them, take them as a refuge, and then it becomes more something more continuous. And the Dhamma in that respect is a refuge also. Again, as we are always chanting, every day we're chanting this. The Dhamma is to be experienced in the here and now, in the immediacy of the moment. It's not bound by time, it's not time-bound. It's timeless, to be individually realized by the wise immediately, without any postponement. again, this pointing towards the direct reality of the moment as it appears in our consciousness in the here and now, isn't it? And then the other refuge is the Sangha, the community. So, you know, we all have to acknowledge that to do this spiritual journey by ourselves can be a really hard task, can be really difficult. I would even say for most of us, or 99.9% of all people, it's an impossibility to have no support, no nourishment to spiritual community, no guidance, no teachers, no people who reflect us back how we appear to them, give us good, wholesome, helpful feedback, not judgmental feedback, but helpful, kind feedback coming from a heart of metta and compassion. That if we don't have that, we don't get that, the spiritual path, or life in general, is very, very difficult, very, very hard. I think our hearts will probably start to shrivel just like become like a dried plum, you know, like a dried plum. You can't eat a dried plum, can you? You have to soak it in water for before it becomes edible. And so the water, if I use this analogy, the water for us, the water of life in the Sangha life, is the community, is the people we live with, the people who give us all the support, the acknowledgement, the feedback and so forth, and the kindness and the compassion which we need. And then we can flourish and we have some good equipment to go the journey all the way from the conventional reality to the ultimate reality. We're using samsaric reality to go to the reality of Nibbana. So this is my reflections for this evening. Thank you for listening.
อันธรรมยังธรรมกถาสาธุการังคถามาเส